welcome to the sixth episode of the Mailbag Podcast. I'm Bill O'Grady, Advisory Director at Confluence Investment Management. Joining me today, as always, is Mark Keller, CEO and CIO of Confluence. We're recording this podcast on December 16th. The idea behind this podcast is to replicate Q&A sessions that Mark and I have participated in for the past 25 years. If you'd like to submit a question, email us at mailbag@confluenceim.com. Each month, we select four or five of the most common, provocative, and interesting questions we receive. Mark and I will address them. So without further ado, let's tackle the first one. First one's an interesting one. Is China positioning for a gold standard for the yuan as the U.S. dollar alternative? How much of the world's reserve buying is China buying, and what do the Chinese really own now? What does the future look like as this unfolds? Impacts on U.S. foreign stocks, commodities, currencies? This is a good question. Unfortunately, it's so broad that we could spend probably five or six sessions on it. But here is what I think is the heart of the matter. It appears that China is trying to create a separate payment system outside the U.S. dollar, U.S. Treasury system. This is being done for two reasons, I think, in part to reduce the impact of American sanctions. In addition, China is looking for a way to pay for commodities with its own currency and not pay with U.S. dollars. But what China appears to be doing is something similar to a gold standard. What China wants is that when nations have a trade imbalance, they settle that imbalance in gold. So a deficit nation would need to acquire gold to balance trade with the surplus nation. Now, here's the twist. In the past, gold standards used fixed exchange rates to currencies. In other words, your currency was fixed to a certain weight in gold. Now, that's not the way the world works anymore. We're in a floating exchange rate to gold world, and a rising price of gold effectively means currency devaluation. So it isn't clear exactly how a balancing action can occur when the gold price is volatile. China is clearly trying to avoid using its sovereign bonds as a reserve asset, as the U.S. did. It believes that this is one of the key reasons why the U.S. is deindustrialized, and I think that's actually accurate. But using gold could provide limits to in its ability to balance trade. Now, one of the things that could happen is, so China runs a, let's say, a trade surplus with country A, and so it needs to be repaid in yuan. But if gold is rising relative to yuan, if you had gold, it would take less gold to balance that trade off. So this might be a situation where it works as long as the gold price is rising. We've really never seen anybody do this before. We've seen gold standards before, that's clear. But we've never seen gold standards when the price of gold is not fixed. And that's the twist on this, and that's what bears watching. I guess in my assessment from a market perspective, and ultimately that's pretty much all we care about, I have a hard time understanding how this would be in any way, shape, or form bearish for gold. Any thoughts on that, Mark?
Well, I they'd love to have the world's most dominant currency, but as you just pointed out, they really don't want to slide in and take the exact same place that the U.S. is in, where, yeah, we're the reserve currency, but we have to run these, you know, large deficits. Our treasuries are all over the world. It forces deindustrialization. They don't want all of that stuff. And so I'm kind of, frankly, a bit of a quandary trying to figure out what direction they're going on this. The one thing we know for sure is they've decided that U.S. treasuries should be a much smaller part of their own central bank portfolio. And they have been buying gold at a rapid rate for at least 3.5 years now. They've always held some gold, but according to their reports, their gold reserves are around just a little shy of 7% of their central bank reserves. But most people think they are not accurately reporting that. And I have a suspicion it's closer to 10%.
Yeah, I've heard numbers between 10 and 15. They're forcing their banks to buy gold, for example. They're also a pretty sizable domestic gold producer, and they are not allowing that gold to circulate, so they're forcing the sale. Now, what we don't know the answer to, or at least I don't know the answer to, and I haven't seen anybody able to answer this, is that what price do the gold companies sell to the government? I don't know if that's below market or not. But it wouldn't shock me if it was a little bit below market, but it can't be too far below market because otherwise you'd get smuggling, and we're not seeing much smuggling.
Right, right, right. And they typically don't require their companies over there to produce, you know, sell below cost. I mean, they're communist, yes, but they, you know, with a capitalist twist, and they do want their companies to survive. And you know, honestly, it would work against them to do that. So I presume that it's not too far below the market price. You know, China has been the major, you know, demand factor in almost every major commodity for over 25 years now. And gold is no exception. I just don't see it ending, to be honest with you. They're a long way from gold being the center weight of the portfolio that they'd like it to be.
Some of this we'll just have to wait and see. You know, the other thing that this is going to interact with is stable coins, which we'll have a lot more to talk about next year on this, because that's another groundbreaking issue that, you know, could upend even the dollar treasury system. But I think we'll leave it here for now. It's a great question. It's just, number one, we don't know enough yet. And number two, it is really in depth. But the one thing I would leave you with is that this is pretty positive for precious metals in general and gold in particular.
Yes.
Question number two. I know that you mentioned a major difference between the idea portfolio and other dividend strategies that we deploy is a strict quality screening here at Confluence. Is it fair to view Confluence as more of a downside protector than its competitors that have a less strict quality approach? Would you say also that in strong up markets, Confluence is likely to lag for the same reason?
Well, there's several things in there. Absolutely, yes. We emphasize quality. And we have a very specific definition of what a quality company is. As we have said many times, if you don't have a strict definition, you know, of what a diamond is, every shiny bead looks like a diamond. And everyone says they buy quality, but honestly, most people don't.
Well, you know, what are you supposed to do? Advertise we buy lousy companies?
Yeah, exactly. So we have a very specific definition of quality, which we think does help us manage risk. But we think business quality and business survivability and prosperity is the best way to protect against risk, risk being defined as the probability of a substantial and permanent loss of capital. It also helps reduce volatility in the portfolio, which is something different, in our view, than risk. But older investors and retired investors in particular don't like a lot of volatility either. High dividends also reduce volatility, above average dividend yields, because stocks, you know, like bonds, do have a duration. And the higher the dividend, the shorter the duration, which reduces the volatility mathematically. And we utilize that, and we utilize diversified portfolio. And the increasing dividend account, we use 2% position sizes. And we think all these things promote lower volatility, lower risk. Now, how about returns? Well, over long periods of time, returns are quite good. But as we pointed out, and this is kind of characteristic of all our value equity strategies, we tend to do quite well in what I'll call normal bull markets. You know, those kind of bull markets where the overall market advances maybe somewhere between 5 and 15% a year. We happen to do much better than average, generally, in bad markets when the market's down. Where we tend to lag is in what we might call raging bulls, which are often typical toward the back half of an expansion where the market's up 20%+. And right now, we're in one of those periods where, frankly, the two things that we do quite well, is invest in quality and invest in growing dividends or in high dividends, are out of favor. Over the last 18 months or so, it'd be hard. Just looking at the returns, not just ours, but dividend stocks in general and high quality stocks of all market caps, they've been really lagging in this market. And we've been through this before. We went through this in the late 90s, just about the same level of concern there, level of lag. But of course, within several years after that early 2000 peak, high quality companies and dividend payers have caught up. I do note some of our competitors in this space, because of that lagging, have been kind of changing their investment criteria in order to buy much lower yielding stocks. We don't buy anything with a dividend yield below 1%, and our usual yield for idea is in the mid twos. Some competitors are buying well below 1% and also allowing position sizes to rise, sometimes over 5%. This adds to volatility, potentially can add to risk, but certainly adds to volatility. And that's a direction we're not going to go.
It's an easy thing to do to change you know, your program. What's hard is to decide when the time is right to go back to what you were doing before. And you will find money managers that have made really fantastic calls. One of the podcasts I listen to is Steve Eisman, who is famous for being short subprime mortgages. And it was a brilliant call. What separated him from everyone else was that he didn't put it on too early. But the other issue is that he wasn't in the business of being in managing money forever. So he kind of made his one call, spiked the football, and been living on it ever since. And bully for him, it was a great call.
Well, what people forget is when you change your investment criteria and change your process, you are also changing your risk, the risk profile of your portfolio. And our commitment is to our clients is not to change the process because we don't want to change the risk profile. Sometimes what you do is out of favor and, you know, you risk not being there when it comes back in favor.
Yeah.
And, you know, you got to make hay when the sun shines and that's your risk.
We'll close this up with one thing I wanted to point out to our listeners. There's an article in the Financial Times written by Ruchir Sharma, who's a columnist for the paper and has had a couple of decades in the financial services industry, usually in emerging markets, but clearly a sharp guy. He wrote a piece on November 30th where he made the point that quality stocks are severely lagging the broader market, or put to another way, they're all on sale. And he said this is like a once-in-a-generation opportunity. Quality companies that have high return on equity, stable earnings growth, low debt, are just unusually cheap compared to factors such as growth or even value. And definitely, if you're interested, I would strongly recommend searching for that article. Question number three, consensus earnings estimates for 2026 are currently coming in at about $306 a share for the S&P, which is about 13% higher than last year. What do you think? Is that achievable? Well, if you look at our 2026 outlook, we are significantly below that. We are not looking for earnings at this level because there is a pretty convincing inverse correlation between operating earnings and the trade deficit. If the White House is successful in narrowing the trade deficit, earnings will almost certainly suffer. Other point that we want to make on this is that operating earnings tend to be frothy the longer the business cycle expands. What recessions do is they give companies the opportunity to kind of get back to that old-timey religion and get the more questionable activities in determining operating earnings out and adjusted. Now, we're living in a world where monetary and fiscal policy have become permanently expansive. Thus, that cleansing effect has been delayed, giving earnings momentum greater sway. In general, though, I think we are at risk to some pretty significant earnings disappointment. Now, I don't necessarily think that's all that bearish for the broader indices, because I just think you're going to get more multiple expansion. You still got a lot of liquidity out there in the system that will tend to support multiple expansion. But this is exactly what we saw in the late 90s. In that situation, the fiscal, ran a fiscal surplus, which has a direct negative effect on earnings, and earnings did fall, but the multiple expanded. And similar outcome is quite possible this year. So the good news is that if we hit a lot of these high targets that you're seeing issued by Wall Street for next year, there's a good chance we'll get them, but we won't get them because earnings are great. We'll get them because multiples expand. Anything to add on that, Mark? No. I know it's pretty brilliant. So.
Yeah. You said it all, Bill. I find, you know, I've been an equity analyst for a long time, and forecasting earnings is about the toughest thing to do. I think you can identify when a stock is cheap, but that's comparatively easy than forecasting what the earnings are going to be. I agree entirely with you that you can hit the earnings number right on the head, and you know it can be a bell ringer. But if it's already in the stock market,
right,
you're just going to see multiples compress. I'd much rather see flat to down earnings in a stock that's washed out that no one cares about, and because generally, you know, expectations are so low, stock could rise. So, yeah, no, I hats off to people who can forecast earnings really well. I'm not sure it's a useful skill.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's like fantasy baseball.
You bet. Yeah.
How are you two guys thinking about next year's changes at the Fed? Well, that's another one of those questions we could go on and on about. Right now, it looks like it's the battle of the two Kevins, Kevin Warsh and Kevin Hassett. And these, in some respects, it's unfair to both people because one is being portrayed as like, you know, an Uber dove and a toady for the president, and the other one is given this cloak of or aura of independence. And you know, I think that's unfair to Kevin Hassett and probably overstates the independence of Kevin Warsh. I'll remind you, Kevin Warsh predicted incorrectly that QE was going to lead to rampant inflation in the last decade. And it did. It just was in equity prices. The only thing I would add, I think if we get a Kevin Hassett, that it's probably going to end up being more dollar bearish than anything. I don't think he will end up being as dovish as the market projects. But I also think it's important to remember that this is a mercurial president that just, you know, when I was a young currency analyst in the 80s, the Bundesbank had this reputation of delighting and wrong-footing currency prognosticators by intervening when they least expected it or changing rates when they least expected it just to mess with the Deutschmark. The president's kind of like that too. He loves wrong-footing people and getting everybody leaning on one side of the boat and flipping it to the other. So don't be surprised if we end up with an out-of-left-field candidate. I mean, Rich Ryder would be the guy who probably would be the biggest surprise to the market. But, you know, anything is possible. And I think, frankly, he would prefer Scott Bessent to have that job and keep his job at the Treasury. I think if he can pull it off, that's what he'll do. I don't think he can, but I think he'll try.
Well, I'll leave the specific prognostications to you, Bill, but I just note that this administration wants a more dovish approach. Clearly, they're going to replace the Fed chair to do that. They're trying to replace at least one governor. They are talking about, you know, interfering in the regional president's process. I just think we're going to get, at the end of the day, and by the end of this administration, a more dovish Fed, which is bad for the dollar, but we've been forecasting a bearish dollar policy. So, I mean, we think that's going to happen, and I think they'd like it too. And it's worrisome for long-term bonds.
It is.
And so I that's, to me, that's kind of the big story. And so as I watch these names come in and watch what they do, I'm going to be watching to see whether that scenario plays out.
The other thing it would be very important to remember, the St. Louis Fed has developed a very large database of dissents at meeting votes going back into the 30s. It's a really good source. And if you go back under periods of market turbulence, it's not at all uncommon to have multiple dissents in both directions at each meeting. And I think that's one of the things you're more likely to start seeing. At our symposium this year, Esther George, who dissented a lot, in fact, I delighted in pointing out to the audience what a dissenter she was. I think she enjoyed it too. Mm-hmm. But
no doubt.
she was saying that, you know, it does take a bit of courage, you know, to dissent, because you're stepping out, and it's not like the chairman, you know, takes you out to the woodshed or anything, but it does take a bit of courage, and so I we're not used to seeing dissents. In fact, Powell, up until recently, had an extraordinarily low level of dissents. So that's something I think we should be prepared for, is that more people saying we should be raising, more people saying we should be cutting. Question number five: hard assets have had a great year. What do you think happens next year?
Well, I'll kick it off. You know, you and I have been managing this global hard asset portfolio for a long time, about 15 years, and we have not always been right.
Oh, baby.
Yeah, no, we can. However, we've been pretty much right this past year and the last couple of years.
Oh, well, we added a couple members. That's probably
why. Well, that helped a lot. Adding Joe Hanslick and Patrick Fearon Hernandez has, I think, helped us. But I think more importantly, we had a theory of what was going on in the world, and have had pretty much that same theory in place for a long time. We were just really early.
Yeah, we were.
Extraordinarily early. A decade early, as a matter of fact. And that led to some of the, you know, bad decisions.
The difficult years.
Yeah. And but I think that the world is kind of, evolving exactly how we thought it would, or pretty close to it anyway. Yeah. And strength in precious metals continues. You know, when gold peaked out around $4,400 not too long ago, a few months ago, I mean, I was thinking we're probably going to enter a period of consolidation. It really spiked out. And I said, it wouldn't surprise me that we head down to around 3,500 and go sideways for a while. Well, here we went down to around 4,000, barely got below 4,000. Now we're back up to like 4,300.
Yeah, we're threatening the highs.
Yeah. And that to me is as a closet technician, that's pretty bullish behavior. So I'm still, think we're pretty well situated. And the industrial metals, in particular copper, acting quite well, as we kind of anticipated they would. And oil is weak, as we had anticipated. In fact, as we sit here today, it's breaking down.
Yeah, it is.
Into the mid-50s. So I think next year's, my guess is it's going to look a lot like last year, but not as ebullient. I don't see gold,
going to 8,000.
I don't see a double in gold this year, but I think the trends will be pretty much the same trends that we saw.
Yeah, I think the big decision, and this is something when we meet every month that we look at, is the next big decision in this portfolio is when do we add more oil? Our energy has been skewed toward uranium and natural gas and coal, and we've reduced oil to just about the lowest percent I think we've ever had.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been the correct call, and we did it because this administration was making a concerted effort to reduce gasoline prices. And we don't think that's done yet, but eventually it will be. And then you're going to have a sector that's washed out and, all those things that you were mentioning earlier about stocks you love. And the trick is that, you don't want to get in too early on this, because to me, the oil weakness looks like a trend that's starting to actually gain momentum. Mm-hmm. So you got to wait this one out. But I think that will be the big decision for next year.
No, I agree entirely. And buttressing that view is the fact that oil stocks, the companies that produce oil, are historically cheap.
Oh, yeah.
By any measure. And, they're at extremely low multiples of low
of a low
earnings,
multiple
of
group.
Of a low earnings, and low cash flows. When it turns, it could be, the pop on the other side could be extraordinary. And I think everybody who watches this group knows that.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's why we are not completely out, but we are as low as we've ever been. But when this turns, it could be pretty violent on the upside in this group. And I think getting it right will be very important. So I agree with you entirely. I think that's going to be the most important call.
Well, and the other part of the call is that it's one thing to say this is the difference between money management and talking about markets. When you're actually managing money, you have to sell some of your favorite children.
Mm-hmm.
And, where do you get the liquidity from? And the problem is, we like the rest of the portfolio too, and it looks like precious metals would be a natural place to get it. But as we mentioned in the first question today, if we've got this historic change going on where half the world is going to go to some kind of gold standard, boy, you don't necessarily want to jump in front of that.
Mm-hmm.
Now the other element of it will be worth watching too is copper, because that's been benefiting from the data center build out. And if we get some kind of shakeout in that next year, it's not inconceivable that copper could maybe take a breather.
And I would say uranium too.
Yeah, uranium.
I mean,
as well.
Both copper and uranium have become AI plays, and and the stocks with them. So both copper and uranium have become AI plays. And, if that trade, spikes out, and it's kind of acting iffy right now, if that trade starts to go the other way, I could see us going that direction too. I don't know, maybe a year from now, we're just...
Same place.
Maybe same place, or maybe it's half gold and half oil. Who knows?
Well, see. The whole point of the hard asset portfolio actually gets to our last question, which is, what's your take on the latest national security assessment? This is, for me, kind of a I told you so moment. My contention has been for the past two decades that the U.S. had lost its political consensus to maintain hegemony as we'd practiced it during the Cold War. And the Washington foreign policy establishment fought it tooth and nail, but I think the election of Barack Obama was the first signal that it was coming to an end, and the election of Donald Trump twice is, if you can't see those tea leaves, you're in denial. And the National Security Assessment, it's clearly a report with multiple authors, and there's some parts in there that are internally contradictory. But I think when I distill it, what I come to is that the U.S. is telling allies in the Western Europe and in the Far East that they're going to have to manage their own security. And we'll be there to help, but they're front line. And they have to decide how they're going to do this. And the U.S. is going to focus a lot on the Western Hemisphere, which I think is exactly what we thought would happen. And the reason we developed the hard asset portfolio was we felt like in a world where you no longer had a hegemon guaranteeing free and open maritime navigation, that you would see the hoarding of commodities. And we're already seeing that with China in spades. And we're not going to spend a lot of time on this because we're toward the end of our comments here. And Patrick's planning on writing a geopolitical report on this next year, which will be, you know, kind of our official position. But again, there's a lot of commentary on it. A lot of it's quite negative. Some of it's quite positive. But, you know, if you've kind of hack through the weeds of it all, what you come to is that, yeah, this is the end of the World War II hegemonic America and the beginning of a multipolar world.
As I read through it, I kept thinking, I've been reading your writings on these subjects for at least 15 years.
Seems like 50, doesn't it?
Seems like 50, yeah. I'm not going to go there.
You're not going to do the old joke about the woman who finds out she's got 6 months to live, and the doctor asks, well, are you married? And she says, no. And he goes, well, you should marry an economist. And it's like, why? Will I live long? He goes, no, but it'll feel like it.
Oh, my. Yes. No, but this is what you've been saying. And, of course, you won me over to that point of view a very long time ago. This is the world that's evolving.
Yeah.
And you and I have both been reading a lot of pre-World War II history and even pre-World War I history. This is kind of the world that existed, especially prior to the Great War in 1914. And, you know, it's not an isolationist strategy, as you've pointed out to me several times. It's a strategy whereby, and hats off to Patrick for talking about these great blocks that are evolving here. It's a multipolar world, and it's kind of like nailing down our place in this new multipolar world. It's also really this national security strategy pretty much announces something I think was already dead, and that is it's the death knell of the old Wilsonian view of foreign policy, that the job of the U.S. is to spread democracy everywhere and make the world safe for democracy. It pretty much says, we're getting out. I mean, after the Gulf Wars of about 20 years ago, and it was pretty obvious to me that the U.S. public was kind of done with that. And I think this just ratifies that. So, yeah, there will be a lot more for us that we'll be writing about. And, yeah, I'm looking forward to reading Patrick's piece on this.
Yeah, you can always tell when you have a permanent change in policy is when you get a new party in power, does the policy flip back? And Biden clearly was trying to flip the policy back. I suspect that when the next Democratic president is elected, that nothing changes.
No, this won't be. I mean, the primary pushback comes from the foreign policy establishment, which has pretty much been running foreign policy for
80 years.
For 80 years. And you and I both read, the journals of that foreign policy, foreign affairs, all that stuff, and these people are beside themselves because the world that they grew up in, they created, and they've lived in is falling apart. And a new foreign policy establishment will arise. But, the inertia of those old establishments lasts. They don't give up easily.
And, to their credit, this is the question that has to be answered. If our great-grandparents could join us in the studio right now and we would tell them, by the way, we're encouraging Germany to rearm, they would probably slap us around a little bit and saying, are you a fool? What's wrong with you? Oh, we're going to do the same thing with Japan. Oh, brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. But there's a term you and I coined, a long time ago called intergenerational forgetfulness. And what tends to happen is that once you get about three generations away from an event, the policy that was put in place for that event gets overturned because people look at it and say, why are we doing all this? What's the point? And so the gamble that we're making effectively is that if Germany and Japan rearm, that the German problem doesn't reemerge in Europe and the Japan problem doesn't reemerge in the Far East. And I frankly don't know the answer to that question, but that is the great uncertainty about the policy direction that we're going.
No doubt it will probably be dealt with by generations well behind us. And
good luck.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Perhaps they'll want to call us into their future studio.
Yeah, that's right, and slap us around.
Slap us around. Why did you do this? Yeah, yeah.
I think that'll do it. This will be the last of our Mailbag podcast for 2025. We'll be back, though, in 2026 to do more, try to do it once a month. Again, as a reminder, if you want to submit a question, send it to mailbag@confluenceim.com. Today's discussion is based upon sources and data believed to be accurate and reliable. Opinions and forward-looking statements are expressed, are subject to change without notice. This information does not constitute a solicitation or an offer to buy or sell any security. Our audio engineer is Dane Stoll.